From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Claims that buses of people from outside New Hampshire are coming to the Granite State to vote can inflame passions along the political spectrum, but the stories don't seem to match reality. Massachusetts officially drops the Northern Pass project in favor of a project in Maine. And what does the firing of VA Secretary David Shulkin mean for the Manchester VA? These and other stories made headlines this week, and we're going to talk about them in this hour. And you can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That is 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and NHPR's Casey McDermott. Good morning. Thank you very much for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning, Peter.
Later in the program, we're going to hear from Trent Spinner of the Union Leader and NHPR's Annie Ropeek. The phone number for you to join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. And just a reminder that we are streaming a live video of this radio show. Very easy to listen and watch. You can check out the stream at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. So we're going to start the show today talking about voters and voting rhetoric. Casey, you wrote an excellent story that dug deeply into the records of voter fraud in the state. You were looking into, the truth behind what we've heard a lot from politicians that you know, buses full of ineligible voters coming to New Hampshire, casting ballots when they shouldn't be casting ballots. Before we go into what you found, tell us a little bit about those allegations specifically. Where do they come from?
Right. So for the last year, there has been kind of a heightened emphasis on this idea of confidence and perceptions around the integrity of not just the national elections, but New Hampshire elections specifically. So we saw the allegations from the president and some of his allies following the 2016 elections that perhaps the results in New Hampshire had been swayed by busloads of Massachusetts voters coming across the border to cast illegal ballots. We've also, heard a lot of talk from New Hampshire politicians who might be quick to, decry that particular allegation and make clear that, no, we don't see any evidence of buses. But at the same time, they will say that there's still just something that people think is not right and that we need to legislate new voting policies to address, either kind of residency requirements or documentation requirements, voter eligibility requirements, in order to show people that, they can trust our elections. But in all of that conversation, I found from sitting through a number of public hearings on the issue in the last year that there was a lot less talk of what we actually know about the voter fraud cases that have happened and have been investigated in New Hampshire. So what I tried to do was to find out more about those specific cases that the state actually has looked into.
Mm-hmm. And fascinating what you found. Listeners, check out Casey's report at nhpr.org. But let's talk a little bit about what you found, because in looking at these cases, did you find any evidence that there was a large coordinated campaign to sway an election one way or another?
So the state's files indicate nothing like that. And so I just to back up a minute as well, I should point out that one of the kind of repeated statements that had been made came from Secretary of State Bill Gardner. Mm-hmm. Has been in charge of New Hampshire's elections for four decades. Has seen his share of really, really close races, hundreds of recounts, high profile races, at the town level all the way up to the Senate president election. His word holds a lot of weight with policymakers. So a number of times over the last year, he has told policymakers that we've had a prosecuted case of voter fraud in every single general election. He said at times going back a dozen years, at other times going back to 1998. So he was actually the first person that I went to looking for backup on those claims. And his office handed me, they were very, open about giving me citations on this. They gave me a stack of file folders that had, news clippings, press releases from the AG's office, various legislative reports. But when I looked at those files more closely, their files didn't have any examples from 2002 or 2006. And the only example from 2010 was actually from a local election. So the secretary had indicated that there was a case involving every kind of general statewide election. So, you know, understanding that there were some gaps in those records, I went to the attorney general's office and basically said, like, look, I'm looking to add some more kind of substance to this conversation that is often driven by kind of rhetoric, perceptions. But, you know, there's, like I said, there's not a lot of kind of specifics. And they were very helpful about giving me what they had. They had recently started to compile this record. And I found it interesting, actually, that, like, just because of the turnover in the AG's office, because of kind of a lack of resources around election enforcement, that no such kind of docket of voter fraud cases in New Hampshire existed in one place until
very
recently.
There was no, like, Excel chart.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I don't know that there still is. So they gave me what are known as kind of closeout letters. So this would be the result of an investigation. And at first they gave me about 76. Since I asked for it, they gave me a handful more. So I think the final total that we have on our report is about 79 investigations into alleged voter fraud, wrongful voting.
Going back how far?
The last 10 years. So between the 2006 and 2010 elections.
Okay.
And of those files, they have issued penalties to about 11 people. Or in about 11 cases, only one of those is a Massachusetts voter who was coming across the border and knowingly, you know, didn't live in New Hampshire and was trying to cast a ballot here. So the other ones were, you know, there were two moms who had filled out absentee ballots for their college-aged sons, which is illegal. You're not supposed to fill out an absentee ballot for someone who is not you. There was in the 2016 election, which I thought was really interesting. There's been all of this talk again about the systemic kind of, you know, caravan of buses coming across the border. The cases from 2016, the first one was an elderly woman who lives in Pelham who filled out an absentee ballot for her husband just several days after he passed away and was caught because of, you know, a local official who noticed the discrepancy between when the man died and when the ballot was submitted. The other one was a man who has since admitted that he's been doing this for years, but has been voting in, he says, only kind of state level, local level elections in both Hudson and Salem, because he said he owned property in both places and thought that that entitled him to an extra vote in both of those places for local offices. He has since been informed that that is, in fact, illegal, and he's not allowed to do that.
And there were people in
Dixville Notch,
right?
Which is really interesting, because this is what we think of as kind of the quintessential New Hampshire voting experience, that midnight voting tradition during the primary, during the general election. Interesting about Dixville Notch, you know, recall that for years and years, that midnight voting tradition came out of the Balsams Resort. The Balsams closed down several years ago. So a lot of the population that used to vote there lost their longtime homes. So what one of those cases of the people who's been flagged in the 2016 election is someone who moved to Stark and no longer, according to the state, maintains his domicile in Dixville that would entitle him to vote there. Another one is a man who, you know, is involved in some kind of property dispute up there, but splits his time between various properties in northern New Hampshire, none of which are actually in Dixville Notch and Martha's Vineyard. But both of them said that they continued to vote in Dixville because they hoped to one day return there. So
not a valid reason to keep voting there, however.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's all of those examples. They don't seem, well, you know, some of them may have been knowingly not doing the right thing, but again, doesn't seem like a coordinated campaign.
A lot of the cases that I found, and there were, you know, like I said, there were less than a dozen where they issued actual penalties. There were a number of others where they were kind of on the line. But, you know, there was either insufficient evidence to convict someone or It looked like it was just an honest mistake. A lot of them looked like just some people who were confused about voting laws and confused about how the voting process worked. There was one case where in 2016, again, an SNHU student, SNHU's campus is kind of right on the line between Hooksett and Manchester, mm-hmm. and went to the polls in, I believe, Manchester, which is where his dorm address was actually located. A poll worker said, no, SNHU is in Hooksett. You have to go vote in Hooksett. He voted in Hooksett. No one, you know, flagged him there. But, you know, when he was flagged by the state, they determined that, you know, he was acting on bad advice. It wasn't anything malicious.
I see. Great information that you've assembled, Casey, but it's not apparently all the information.
Right.
Secretary of State Bill Gardner says he's going to release more in June. What's that going to look like?
Yeah, so it's important to note that the first of all, the files that I'm referring to are not not exhaustive. The Attorney General's office even has like hundreds of open cases dating back to 2012. Those involve both voting fraud complaints and other kinds of election complaints. And the state has, you know, had kind of spotty election enforcement over the last few years, like I said, because of a lack of, you know, adequate resources or investigators on staff. They've really been making an effort to pick up the pace on that. But separately, the Secretary of State's office has been granted larger investigative power. They now have their own kind of election attorney that's looking into alleged cases of fraud or cases where someone might not have been able to verify either their identity or their domicile at the polls and get sent, you know, follow-up and, you know, there are questions that arise about whether they were actually eligible to vote where they tried to. So the Secretary of State's office is looking into that. They also have entered into a program called the Cross-Check Program, which allows them to compare voter registration data with other states. So what they're doing is looking for people who might be registered in two places and then going from there to determine whether or not they can, you know, make a determination as to whether someone cast a ballot in two states. It's important to note that just because you're registered in two states doesn't necessarily mean that you've done anything illegal. A lot of states, you know, lag behind on updating their voter rolls. It's not always second nature for someone when they move to a new state to remove their voter registration information from their old state. So that kind of the numbers about how many people have been flagged as being registered are not necessarily the number of people who've committed voter fraud. It's just a starting point. So that's all to say that the Secretary of State's office has told me as well that they, you know, are working on their own investigations. They plan to release this report by the filing deadline, which I believe is June 15th. So by the end of June, we should have, you know, a fuller picture from the Secretary of State's office about what they believe the problem looks like.
Mm-hmm. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and coming up on the show, a discussion of the Northern Pass Project. Massachusetts has officially dropped it in favor of a project in Maine. Was New Hampshire's decision to kill the Northern Pass Project a mistake? Do you have high hopes for Eversource, the project's developer, and its appeal of the state's decision? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange at nhpr.org. I also want to mention a program that we're going to be doing on Monday. On Monday, the Exchange kicks off its Race for the First series with candidates for the first congressional district. And first up is Mindy Mesmer, Democratic State Representative from Rye. That is on Monday, April 2nd. And you can send your questions for the candidate to exchange at nhpr.org. I want to welcome Trent Spinner, the union leader, here with us now. Thanks for being here, Trent.
Of course. Thank you.
Yep. And I just want to follow up on something Casey was saying with you, Trent, about the cross-check program, because this week in the union leader, Senator Regina Birdsell wrote an op-ed in support of, or rather criticizing SB 349, which would remove New Hampshire from that cross-check program. What was her argument?
So the cross-check program, here's what it does. If you move around the country, what it does is it takes your first name, your last name, and your date of birth, and it tries to cross-reference those to make sure that you're not voting in more than one state. There are approximately 30 states that are a part of this, and some people in New Hampshire would like to remove the state from that program because they argue that for every illegal voter. And Casey mentioned there was that voter from Massachusetts who came up and he lived in Carver, Mass., but was voting in New Hampshire. So for every example like that, there are approximately 200 examples of people who just happen to have the same name. And so some people would like to remove New Hampshire from that because they feel like it disables people from being able to vote. There are other programs available, and other states are looking at other ways of doing this. But the main argument there is, you know, for the limited number of cases that this thing catches, it's not worth it.
Mm-hmm. So how strong is the support for this bill that would take us off the cross-check program?
You know, I don't know specifically whether this bill will pass. You know, there is a lot of concern over everything that has to do with voting in this cycle. One of the things that is so interesting to me as we've covered this, because we've gone out there and tried to find these buses, trying to find people with evidence of these buses. You know, when the president of the United States says something, we go out and try and, you know, back that up, find that evidence and see if there's a real story there. We have not been able to do that. But what's interesting about this is that if you changed the language of the argument, right? If you said there are busloads worth of people from out of state voting in New Hampshire, that's technically accurate. Thousands of people from out of New Hampshire newly registered to vote using out of state IDs every year. And so it's interesting, this whole thing is the arguments kind of on both sides are a little opaque because of the language that's being used. It's not particularly accurate.
Well, as Casey was mentioning, it's an issue of intent, of coordinated intent to bring people into the state for the specific reason of changing an election outcome. And, you know, Casey's research is really interesting. And when you look at it at that granular level, you see all kinds of different reasons for why people may have run afoul of the laws. Either they don't know the law, they had good intentions, but their logic was faulty. I'm sure there are some cases where maybe it's a little more intentional. But the kinds of voter fraud claims that we deal with at the level of rhetoric are very different. There are arguments about large systematic attempts to swing the election in a particular direction. That's what we dealt with mostly in the last election. The cross-check, it's associated with Chris Kobach, the Kansas Secretary of State who's running for governor. He was the co-chair of the voter fraud commission that was shut down. So I think some people sort of look at that program a little bit askance. But, you know, my guess is that we'll see what comes out in the report from Secretary Gardner in June. But, you know, I think people are going to continue to believe that on both sides that there either is fraud or there isn't fraud. I just think it's part of the electoral narrative at this point. And, you know, the human mind is very good at filtering out information that goes against prior beliefs. And I talk to conservatives and they're convinced that people are being bussed into the state and that Trump really won the popular vote, but people voted illegally. And it's just very hard to undo that at this point. I think my concern is that maybe Gardner's report will be helpful, but it could conceivably just kind of muddle things a little bit more.
I think one of the things that's interesting and important to point out that Trent mentioned is there's a distinction here between fraud as defined by, you know, committing an illegal act under the existing New Hampshire laws. And that's what I was trying to look at in my reporting. But there are a lot of people who argue that what the laws allow right now amounts to fraud. And that's a different conversation.
That's a different argument. That's a change the rules argument.
Certainly a different show, worthy of at least an hour. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We're speaking with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital, NHPR's Casey McDermott and Trent Spinner of The Union Leader. We're going to talk a little more about Secretary of State issues, including challenges to Secretary of State Bill Gardner. We've got a new one this week. We will go over what happened with that. We'll also talk with NHPR's Annie Ropeek about what's going on with Northern Pass, the Coakley landfill, and also the maple industry. Give us a call now so we can bring you into the conversation when it starts. The number is 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We will be right back.
Spring is just about here, and Morning Edition is hitting the road. In our new weekly series, we're traveling across the Granite State to take you to new places and introduce you to new people.
Yeah, the moon looks very cinematic. What are we expecting to see tonight?
Now, people come here to see the alpacas.
Homebrewers starting out, how do you get from just whipping up batches in your basement to opening up your own tasting room?
Listen to Radio Field Trips, Morning Edition's new series about New Hampshire life and culture, Wednesday mornings from 5 to 9 on NHPR.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, NHPR's Casey McDermott, NHPR's Annie Ropeek, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website NH Political Capital. Join us now to talk about things like Northern Pass, Coakley, maple syrup production, and how or whether climate change has anything to do with it. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can email exchange at nhpr.org. We're going to start this conversation, this section of the show, with a continuation of what we've been talking about for the first part, which was voting issues, in particular Secretary of State Bill Gardner, because he's got a few challengers now for his position, including Peter Sullivan, former Manchester representative and alderman. He's putting himself out there as an alternate to Bill Gardner as Secretary of State. He is joining Democrat Colin Van Ostern, who is actively campaigning for the seat. Casey, what do we know about Peter Sullivan?
Yeah, so as you said, he used to be involved in both city-level government in Manchester and state-level government at the State House. And I think I would actually characterize him as putting himself forward as an alternative to Colin Van Ostern. And, you know, while Sullivan says that he believes that Gardner has, served his time well and that the office is in more need of modernization and needs to change and that he has a number of quibbles with the incumbent, I get the sense that he is actually much more frustrated with the other candidate who has put himself forward.
Why?
He says that it's just not right to launch a campaign, as Colin Van Ostern has done, with the stated intent of fundraising and injecting a lot of money into legislative races in exchange for support for your agenda as Secretary of State. Sullivan said that it's just really it should not be a quid pro quo, is the way that he's described it. It shouldn't be based on who handed you, a $50, $100 check for your own state rep campaign, which is kind of what Van Ostern has proposed in terms of funding legislative candidates who would support him when it came time to have the Secretary of State election. That Sullivan says it should be a question of ideas, not of money.
Right. Is Colin Van Ostern actively saying you guys need to vote for me if I
support you? It's not
you?
That you need to. He said it's not a matter of supporting candidates who say that they will vote for me. It's candidates who will support my stated agenda and gotcha. Stated priorities. So there's a distinction there. But nonetheless, this is an unusual approach that we've not seen in Secretary of State campaigns ever in New Hampshire. And I think that Sullivan is definitely not the only person that I've seen who has raised questions about whether this in any way contaminates this race that has historically been free from the kind of outside money that we've seen in other, other races in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. And one of the concerns people have been bringing up is that when you start to inject politics and partisan positions into the Secretary of State's office, you risk losing New Hampshire status as the first in the nation for the presidential primary. This is an argument that's been embraced more by the GOP than others. But Trent, what is the argument there that the GOP is trying to make? What's the connection?
Well, you have to remember the history. So Bill Gardner was a Democrat. Steve Dupree was a Republican now, and is part of the GOP committee that decides the calendar. And they ran against that. Dupree wanted to be Secretary of State, but Gardner, but he kind of ceded the election to Gardner. And I wasn't there for that. This was 35 years ago or so. So I don't know all the details of what happened there, but they have a lot of respect for each other. And so Dupree's able to go to the national committee and say, hey, listen, we can trust New Hampshire elections. They won't be there's none of this partisan stuff involved in those elections, and we can trust Bill Gardner. And that has been the argument now for three decades, the two of these guys kind of protecting New Hampshire's primary. And the argument is that with somebody who is more political, that will go away. And remember, there's a really interesting this is going to be one of the most interesting races, I think, that we cover, one of the most interesting elections. Every state picks a Secretary of State in a different way. New Hampshire is pretty special in that the legislature actually selects the Secretary of State after they're seated. So you can't go to the polling place and vote for Bill Gardner or Colin Van Ostern. You can't. The legislature. And here's the thing. whoever wants to be Secretary of State has to do all that politicking probably before they're seated, because the election is pretty quick after the legislature convenes. So you don't really have time to run a campaign once you even know who's going to be in those seats.
Casey?
And actually, just to put in a plug, The Exchange did a really interesting show specifically looking at the office of Secretary of State and how New Hampshire fits into kind of the landscape of similar offices around the country earlier this week. I would recommend checking that out just for some more context on what Trent was saying about how we choose ours versus how other states choose theirs. But I think that that's also an important point, that a lot of this hinges on just what the makeup of the legislature is after the elections this fall. There's been, you know, some speculation that perhaps the Democrats could ride some kind of wave. I think that remains to be seen how that will actually, you know, bear out. But I think that's what Van Alstyne is banking on, is that, you know, there will be an infusion of kind of new Democrats in the legislature who will also be eager to have someone new in the Secretary of State's office. Now, one of the advantages that Gardner has is that he has 40 years of relationships that he's built up with the people who are in charge of reappointing him every 2 years. So it really depends on just, you know, how much of a flip is in store for the state level elections.
Yeah, and I think there was a very interesting show yesterday. I encourage listeners to check it out. I think one of the statistics on the show was something like a third of the House turns over every 2 years, and if it's a wave election, it could be as much as 50%. So you may not have the same kind of allegiance to Gardner. You know, Van Alstyne's strategy, it is a gamble, because if he doesn't get the Democratic seats he needs in the next election, and the idea is that by helping out with fundraising and sponsoring various campaigns, he can build relationships. But if he doesn't get enough seats, it's not going to happen. And putting in another potential Democratic candidate makes for some more potentially interesting politics for people who maybe want to move on from Gardner but think that Van Alstyne is too political. This might be another alternative.
Last question about voting issues. With respect to the first-in-the-nation primary, the New Hampshire legislature decides when that primary is, right?
That's
correct. It's a law.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I thought. And if that is the case, then why would the election of whoever is Secretary of State put that in jeopardy? I guess what I'm asking, how much power do the national political parties have, and why would they care?
They have a lot of power, because as much as the law is that the voting has to happen, the parties get to decide how the delegates are decided. So New Hampshire could have as many elections as they wanted. It wouldn't matter if both parties say, yeah, you get one delegate because of your vote, because you broke with our calendar.
So we could still have it first, but if we irritate the major parties, they could give us so few delegates that it would be essentially neutered.
Often what happens is the parties say we're going to refuse to receipt the delegates. You know, in the end, the candidate, whoever's going to be the nominee, says, no, we'll seat the delegates. It typically happens at the last minute, but it causes a lot of problems for how people view the validity of the primary as it's happening. So that would be the concern, but it is set by state law, but the parties do attempt to have an influence on the schedule. It's cyclical, not every 4 years, but it does happen periodically.
Okay, we're going to leave behind the election issues. I want to thank NHPR's Casey McDermott for joining us for this part of the show. Casey, thank you very much for being
here. Thanks for having me.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We've been speaking with our guests today about the week's news, and if you've got questions, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Coming up in about 15 minutes or so, we're going to be speaking about VA Secretary David Shulkin, or should I say former VA Secretary David Shulkin. He is the latest abrupt departure from the Trump administration's cabinet. What does this mean for the Manchester VA or for veterans in general? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, which is where we've got a live video broadcast of this show. Let's turn now to NHPR's Annie Ropeek, who has been covering the Northern Pass Project for many, many months now. Annie, Massachusetts decided to go with a project from Maine instead of Northern Pass, which was shot down by the Site Evaluation Committee here in New Hampshire a couple of months ago. Why is this decision happening now?
Yeah, that's right. So it basically is happening because of what New Hampshire decided to do back in February, right at the end of January, where they denied Northern Pass its final building permit. So that decision came out right after Massachusetts had tapped Northern Pass to be its big clean energy supplier. It really threw a wrench in the works, and they've been dealing with that as they go through contract negotiations over the past several weeks. They pulled this main project in, which is called New England Clean Energy Connect. It's developed by Central Maine Power, also fueled by Hydro-Québec. So kind of a similar project to Northern Pass in a lot of ways. And they kind of pulled that in as their plan B. And if they couldn't make it work with Northern Pass, if they didn't get their permit in time, they were going to go with that plan B. And that's what they've ended up doing.
Okay. So will this provide the same kind of regional environmental benefits? In other words, is the grid still going to get just as much renewable energy?
Yeah, in theory. I mean, it is about the same amount of megawattage of hydro power from Canada. It will come on, you know, a big transmission line that will go through a lot of forested parts of Maine, some residential areas. It's a little bit smaller scale and cheaper of a project than Northern Pass is or was going to be, although it still costs about $1 billion. Has strong support from the governor there. And, you know, Massachusetts really has signaled that they wanted to buy a big chunk of hydropower, and they figured out how to do that.
Okay. And this does not sound like good news for Eversource.
No, not at all. They are, you know, pushing ahead with their appeals process for their permit. They're saying they predated the Massachusetts procurement effort, and, you know, they plan to outlast it, that they'll try to find another buyer on the other side of all this. They're going to focus, they told me, on getting their permit for now. That appeals process is just getting started. It's likely to end up at the state Supreme Court. That could happen months from now. It could stretch into next year, if it's even successful at all. And then if they win the appeal, they'd have to go back and fight for the permit again. And that, you know, is a whole nother thing. So really unclear path ahead for them. And if they do end up ever getting their permit, they would still have to seek sort of another financial backer. That's essentially what Massachusetts was going to be. It was going to help them pay for the project.
Financial backer, you mean people who are lined up to buy the power that they're producing, right?
Right, making it cost effective, or making sure that it would that they'd be able to recoup the costs that they were investing in building the line. So they'd have to look for another state-level kind of power buy like Massachusetts was doing. There are a lot of those in the works. Connecticut and Rhode Island have said that they are getting ready to do some of that. And Massachusetts may be getting ready to do another one as well. Or there could be a private sector investor who might want to come on board. But Eversource is kind of putting that second priority for now.
Right. So what about this project from Maine? Like, how's that moving along?
So it actually is in roughly the same boat as Northern Pass. It still needs its final state permit from Maine's Public Utilities Commission. It's facing some opposition there from competing utilities, from environmentalists, a lot of similar concerns to Northern Pass. But it has strong support from Maine's governor, and he has said he's going to push it through the Public Utilities Commission. So kind of remains to be seen if they would take the same step that New Hampshire did and sort of defy all of that support and deny the permit or not. And so that's happening in the next several months.
Okay. I'm sure we'll hear from you about this again, Annie. Let's talk about another issue with respect to the environment, and that's Coakley Landfill. There's some movement on that this week, but I want to start from the very beginning because not all our listeners may be familiar with what the Coakley Landfill is. So can you tell us about what's happening at Coakley?
Yeah, very good place to start. So Coakley Landfill is a federal Superfund site. This is an Environmental Protection Agency toxic waste site that's designated for special funding, special cleanup, and sort of set aside as being one of the higher level hazards, environmental hazards in the country. There's, you know, not that many of these sites in the country, although there are a lot. But so Coakley Landfill was a former municipal, military, industrial waste landfill, kind of combined solid wastes in Greenland, New Hampshire, right on the seacoast. And it shut down many decades ago and then was found to be full of bad things. And so it was actually one of the first Superfund sites that when they first formed the program back in the 80s. Back then, they decided to just put a cap on the landfill. So stop it from evaporating things into the air, stop it from being able to be accessed by humans. They did not put anything underneath it. They didn't take any of the waste out or treat any of the waste. They just figured it would kind of, because it was a lot of biodegradable hazards that they knew about then, and they figured it would sort of go away on its own. Fast forward to now, we know about a lot of new chemicals that don't biodegrade, and it's full of those as well. Those are known as PFCs, perfluorinated chemicals, stuff that's used in firefighting foams, in a lot of industrial household products, nonstick things, Teflon, and they are thought to cause cancer. These are what the EPA calls an emerging contaminant or a sort of they're in their early stages of regulating and researching these things, so not a ton is known about them, but people are really worried that Coakley is full of these and that they're leaching into the groundwater, so that Coakley underneath is kind of spreading these through the earth into local wells, into streams, and they have turned up in some local wells and streams, although not at a level that the EPA says is serious enough for them to take serious action. And so that's kind of been the fight, is whether Coakley needs stronger cleanup than it's already had or not.
Mm-hmm. And what, according to the state's Seacoast Cancer Cluster Commission, is the connection between the Coakley Superfund site and cancer cases on the seacoast?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, the Cancer Cluster Commission was formed to look at all possible causes of this sort of spate of childhood cancer cases that are really rare and weird that we saw on the seacoast in recent years. And they've really honed in on Coakley as a likely cause of that. Now, the fact is that scientists and health officials say they can't prove or disprove that Coakley is the cause of those cancer cases. And for a lot of lawmakers on the seacoast, that is not a good enough answer to say we don't need to do something about Coakley. And they're looking at it as something they can do something about. And so they're really pushing to do more serious remediation at Coakley, what they call pump and treat, where they would actually like take out some of the waste, clean it up and put it back in. And they're fighting with the EPA and the state about that.
What's so interesting about this, as reading some of the reporting on it, is that, you know, state legislators and others are interested in figuring out a way to deal with remediation more aggressively. It is a federal Superfund site, and the EPA has said you can't override the EPA. You can't set a more aggressive cleanup schedule unless we say it's okay. And so you have these attempts. There was a Senate bill to give the Department of Environmental Services more oversight and ability to have an aggressive cleanup. But there is this sort of interesting subplot of a conflict with the EPA rules governing Superfund cleanup. And I guess they're going to do some kind of study in the bedrock to see if this is leaching into the water table.
Yeah, no, it is really interesting. So Coakley is governed by what we call a consent decree, which is a settlement, a court settlement between the EPA and the potentially responsible parties, which are the towns, mostly towns, actually mostly Portsmouth, and a number of private businesses who they say are responsible for the pollution at the landfill. So the EPA basically made a deal directly with those folks to figure out how to clean it up, how to pay for cleanup. And they're saying that the state can't come in and do its own cleanup and get money from those potentially responsible parties. The bill you mentioned actually, the sponsors of that bill, which includes Representative Mindy Messmer from Rye, say that the bill spells out why exactly in state law the state can do it. And so if that bill passes, I think that could be a really interesting kind of showdown between the EPA and the state on who exactly is in charge of Coakley, what exactly is wrong with Coakley, and who has the authority to do something about it.
And just a reminder to our listeners that coming up on Monday, as part of our Race for the First series, we will be speaking with Mindy Messmer, Democratic State Representative from Rye. You can send questions for her to exchange@nhpr.org. But right now, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. We've been speaking with NHPR's Annie Ropeek, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHPR. You. And with you, we hope, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or send your questions about the week's news by email to exchange@nhpr.org. Coming up, we're going to talk about the possible links between maple syrup production in New Hampshire and climate change. We'll also talk about the change of leadership nationally at the Department of Veterans Affairs. We'll also talk about attempts to inject more money into the state's opioid treatment community. That's all coming up on The Exchange. Again, the phone number to call to lend your voice to the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, and NHPR's Annie Ropeek. Call us now to join the conversation. The number is 1-800 1-800-892-6477. And Annie, you reported this week that climate change is making its mark on maple syrup production in New Hampshire. Who's arguing that it is, and what are they arguing that it's doing?
Yeah, so, I mean, I got to say, I wasn't expecting this to be as controversial as it's turned out to be.
I know, right?
It's a new area for me. And so I went to the annual Climate and Pancakes Breakfast in Plymouth. It's hosted by a number of environmental groups in the state every year. And they have a maple syrup producer come, talk about the changes he's seeing. They have scientists talk about the latest research on stressors affecting maple trees and on how climate change might be affecting those stressors. So it was the folks from Mount Washington Observatory from Plymouth State. And basically they say, you know, maple syrup or maple trees, which is where we get maple syrup, are affected by drought and extreme weather. They're affected by acid rain, which comes from air pollution from power plants, mostly to the west of us. And they're affected by new pests and diseases. And all of these things are volatile, right? And so we don't know what climate change is going to do to a lot of those factors. Acid rain is improving because emissions are going down, but weather is getting stranger and more erratic, and the seasons are changing, and the seasons are starting earlier and later. And so it's a time of change for maple syrup, I think is fair to say. And it's unclear how a lot of these factors are going to get worse or get better in the coming years.
I spoke to a maple syrup producer within the past month or so from Berlin who said that, you know, the change that he has seen is that his season simply starts and ends earlier. It's not affecting the quantity that he's able to produce from his stock of trees. Is that generally what you're hearing?
I think that was the biggest sort of environmental change that the maple syrup producer who was there, who, by the way, it was a joy to witness him just down a glass of maple syrup in front of everyone. And that was really impressive to me. I've never seen anyone do that before. But
have you tried it yourself yet?
I have not tried drinking an entire glass of maple syrup.
Well, all right. So let's say, how many ounces in this glass? I'm curious.
Like
it's not
like
a shot glass. It's
no, like a cup.
All right.
But so that was impressive. Side note.
What was the reason for doing that?
Have you had maple syrup, Dean?
I have, not as
it was like, it's good for you.
Yeah, Lord.
It's, you know, it's his form of advertising. So so he says season's starting earlier and later. I was talking to a maple syrup producer yesterday who said, he is really tired. They've been working around the clock. Like once it rains, it pours with this stuff, you know. And so I think that the seasonal timing change is not a huge problem for them. It's just something they have to adapt to. He says their bigger concerns are some of these economic pressures, regulatory pressures, new inspections, and things like that they're going to have to deal with. That is making it harder to be a small-scale maple syrup producer in New England.
Mm-hmm. And your story at nhpr.org, someone pointed out that there might be some non-climate change-related things that are affecting it, like, for example, invasive species not really have anything to do with climate change.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Like, there are so many, you know, primary and secondary effects of climate change, right? And you can tie everything to it. You can tie nothing to it. And invasive species, new pests are one of those things that, you know, might be getting exacerbated by changing climate. It might not be. We know that things like ticks, for example, are encouraged by warmer winters and less snow because it gives them more places to breed. And so certain species are able to move into new areas because of the way the weather is changing there that might not have been there before. So, you know, we do see more invasive species, more pests affecting trees and plants that they might not have affected in the past because they couldn't survive here. I honestly can't say if some of the pests that maple trees are experiencing are part of that category, but it's certainly a concern for any agricultural producer, you know, that as your climate changes in your area and your seasons change, that new things might be able to adapt to those changes and come in and kind of throw off your game.
All right. Well, NHPR's Annie Ropeek, thank you very much for joining us and speaking with us about all these environmental issues. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. We've got a few more stories to talk about in this hour, including former VA Secretary David Shulkin. He's out. President Trump has nominated a White House physician to replace him as head of the government's second largest bureaucracy. Trent, do you know if Secretary Shulkin was given an official reason for his firing or he was just out?
Well, if you read what he says,
Secretary Shulkin,
he had an op-ed in the New York Times and actually spoke to NPR He said that he was there were all these political forces working against him, political forces who were trying to privatize the VA. He said that this story about him bringing his wife to Europe, including while the Manchester VA scandal was breaking, that was being pushed by these people who were against him politically, and that he was told by the White House that he cannot respond to those stories. So he said his hands were really tied. But once he was no longer the secretary of the VA, he really let his opinions be known. And it was interesting to see a cabinet secretary kind of dish on the president and the administration like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was interesting. Dean, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say it is interesting because a lot of times when cabinet officials are removed, they just kind of go off into the sunset and they don't say anything, or maybe they write a book down the road. But he was on NPR almost immediately after he was removed. And he told this really interesting story last night of talking to President Trump about the agency and the direction they were headed. And then a few hours later, getting a call from Chief of Staff Kelly that he was going to be removed. And then the tweet came out shortly thereafter. And so, he has talked about political appointees having it in for him and that they're not moving quickly enough towards privatization. He is a holdover from the Obama administration. We know Trump likes to sort of go in the opposite direction from the Obama administration. But it's been interesting because his name has been out there for a while now. He had the dust up over his travel expenses with his wife at a conference in Europe. He says there was nothing unusual about that. So we'll see how the confirmation hearing goes for the White House physician, who oversees, I think, a staff of maybe 100 or 200, going to a agency that is the second biggest behind the Pentagon. It's over 350,000 employees, something like that.
Ed Coyce, one of the Manchester VA whistleblowers, he had built a relationship with Secretary Shulkin since news broke about allegations of substandard care. Apparently, Ed Coyce and Secretary Shulkin kept in touch, and Coyce kept Shulkin apprised of what's been happening at the Manchester VA. Here's what Dr. Coyce had to say about Shulkin's firing.
I think it's a real kick in the stomach, actually. I think that he took a vested interest in the Manchester VA. I can tell you that there were projects that we worked on, including recently the Luke Arm with Matt Albuquerque and Dean Kamen, that he was a big supporter of, and he helped cut through a lot of red tape just to see it get accomplished. And he was also very supportive of Al Montoya, our director. So I think we're going to lose that.
That's Dr. Ed Coyce of the Manchester VA speaking about Secretary Shulkin's firing this week. Speaking to Ed Coyce earlier this week, he mentioned that he is also unsure if the new VA secretary, if he's confirmed, will even have Manchester on his radar. So that's really a concern that he seems to share with a lot of people. So this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We've got a few more stories to talk about this week, including a bill in the New Hampshire Senate that attempts to get more money to nonprofits by fighting the opioid epidemic by channeling it through the Community Development Finance Authority. Trent, what is the Community Development Finance Authority?
This is a program that will allow here's the problem. There are all these opioid and recovery organizations who are on the front lines of this who need money. There are a number of businesses who say, we need help because our employee base is stretched thin. We can't hire people because of this problem. And so what the governor did was said, hey, is there a way we can connect these two groups? So what this plan would do is it would allow these businesses to essentially use tax credits, so make donations to the Community Development Finance Authority. And then that authority would the state would grant money to recovery organizations. So it's kind of a win-win for everybody. Here's the problem is that we're kind of getting late into the legislative season at this point. The House Ways and Means Committee was not aware of this earlier, and they had some concerns about just how all these mechanics would work. How do the businesses make those donations? How does the money get granted? Who's doing that? Who's making those decisions? And so they would like to shelve this idea for another year. So we'll see what happens. The House can override that committee vote. But we'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm. The committee vote was, 20-0, so...
Right. Yeah, in favor of tabling it. Yeah, but the governor supports it. I mean, it's part of, apparently, his broader initiative, the Recovery-Friendly Workplace Initiative. What exactly is that?
So that's an initiative that is being opened up to other states that just basically makes it easier, gives employers guidelines for how to have people who are recovering from some form of addiction in their workplace. If you look at all the polling... Recovery, the opioid epidemic is the number one biggest concern in New Hampshire right now. The economy is far behind. So this is a big issue that people are trying to figure out how to deal with. And as an employer, let's say you run a restaurant or you run a small hotel or something like that, and you need people to make that business work. If you're having to deal with recovery issues, there's really no place to go to understand how to do that.
Mm-hmm. Another bill that worked its way through the legislature this week, at least passed the Senate, would allow teenagers to work more hours per week. Trent, how many more hours are we talking about here?
So I didn't realize that right now, anyone under the age of 17 is not allowed to work more than 30 hours during a school week. On school vacation or summer break, you can work 48 hours. This bill would allow teenagers, they have to get permission from their parents, but it would allow them up to 48 hours a week during the school year and then 56 hours a week during the summer vacation, which seems like a lot of hours. It also would kind of change the way that the Department of Labor investigates claims of fraud or abuse of this. It would kind of pare back those investigations and make it more difficult to find businesses.
Okay. And is that the intent, to just make it easier for businesses to sort of hire these young people and keep them working?
That's right. And Republican State Rep Andy Sanborn from Bedford is one of the co-sponsors. He runs a restaurant right here in Concord. And he talked about how this is an issue for small businesses. It's an issue of clarity. How many hours are you supposed to work? When are you supposed to be doing that? And it's also an issue of enforcement.
Yeah. And both of these issues that we're just talking about right now are all driven by a very tight labor market.
Certainly, certainly. And do Democrats have an opposing argument for this, or?
They do. I think that there's some concern about the number of hours. I mean, 40 hours.
And the reduced oversight, I think, as well, is a little bit of a concern.
Yeah. Could you imagine working 48 hours while going to school
full-time?
That'd be incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
We've got a few more stories to talk about, so let's run through them real quick, including Medicaid expansion. Got an ought-to-pass recommendation from the House Health and Human Services Committee this week. So what's next for Medicaid expansion?
It has to go to the full House. It already passed the Senate. This was the surprise would have been if this committee voted against it, because this thing has been worked on for so long at this point. It's been worked on in the Senate for several months. It was overwhelmingly passed in the Senate. There were concerns. There are still concerns that the overall House, don't forget, there are a number of very conservative House members who are opposed to the program in any form. But the people who crafted this bill think that the way it was constructed will get through the House. The committee vote was expected. It would have been a kind of a shocker if they voted the other way. You never know what happens in the full House, but it's looking good for Medicaid.
You could,
expansion.
In theory, have some sort of odd alliance of conservatives who want to end the program and progressives or liberals who don't like the work requirement or think that the work requirement is not helpful to the overall program.
You could, and that would be a fascinating.
Yeah. Happens occasionally, not often, but it would be interesting.
Yes.
SB 193, a plan to create education savings accounts for New Hampshire families, drew opposition at a press conference this week. What are opponents saying about this bill?
Opponents are saying, well, let's just back up and explain what this is. This right now, the state pays a certain amount of money. I think it's about $3,000 per student to public schools. So that's the state, aid for local school districts. This would allow that money, parents to make a decision to say that money should not go directly to my public school. It should instead go to an education savings account. And the way this bill is crafted, it would allow those education savings accounts to pay for tuition at private schools, religious schools. The press conference we saw this week were from people who are very involved in public education, superintendents, those types of people. And they're adamantly opposed to this, which I can understand. And they, because of their position, they say that this takes money away from them. The Josiah Bartlett Center, a conservative think tank in Concord, said that at the same time, said that what these people were saying, what the superintendents were saying, it wouldn't be quite as bad as they are making it out to be, that the education savings accounts would not have a massive impact on public education like they're claiming. So
there's also been some concern. The AG's office had originally expressed some concern over the inclusion of religious schools in this bill, and then it changed its position and said it thought that the bill could pass constitutional muster, because the assumption has been that if this passes, it'll end up in the courts because of the issue of religious schools. And there's still some concern about this, and people want to hear the AG's underlying rationale for that change of position. So that's one potential wild card.
All right. Final thing. Baseball season has begun, and apparently the first game of the season for the Red Sox didn't go so well, lost to Tampa Bay. Hey, we got 161 more of these to go, right? So hopeful, yes. Maybe not you, Trent.
Yeah. I hear we're fellow Yankees fans.
We are. I can't help how that. I was raised, I should say.
It sounded like a terrible game. I listened to the end of it, and it just sounded like the Red Sox just totally crumbled at the end. I heard one stat on while I was listening that they hadn't blown a 3-0 lead all of last year, and then in the very first game of this year, they blow a 4-0 lead. So
thanks. Okay, but Yankees did all right. They beat the Blue Jays yesterday. In fact, Giancarlo Stanton homered twice.
I love it.
Okay, good start. But again, same can be said for the Yankees, right? So you've got 161 more of these to go. And for anyone wondering, by the way, the New Hampshire Fisher Cats home opener is scheduled for Friday, April 13th against Hartford. And who doesn't love a good minor league baseball game, right?
Especially when it's sunny out there.
Yeah.
At the stadium.
Yeah, there's not a bad seat in the house.
They have fireworks at night. Can't go wrong.
And it's pretty close. That's also good. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here this hour. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
That's Trent Spinner of the Union Leader and Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Thanks also to NHPR's Annie Ropeek and Casey McDermott, who joined us earlier in the show to talk about the stories they have covered this week. And you can find a link to all the stories that we discussed today at nhpr.org. Just a reminder that on Monday, we're kicking off our series Race for the First on the Exchange. That's a series of conversations with candidates for the first congressional district. We're going to be speaking with Mindy Mesmer, Democratic State Representative from Rye, on Monday, April 2nd. You can send your questions ahead of time to exchange@nhpr.org. The conversation about the stories we discussed today continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.